Germ Warfare is Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Laura Logan, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you, Jeremy. Good to be here.
I love chatting to you, by the way. Your accent always makes me smile.
It's a lot like your accent.
but you've got this Americanized thing going on now.
Yeah, because when I was in the recording booth at 60 Minutes, if I said things that people didn't understand, they were like, what? I remember I said, Mogadishu. And they were like, it's Mogadishu? And I'm like, I don't think so. Is it Africa? And as an African, I get to call it whatever we call it. And they said, well, but people won't know what you're talking about. They'll think it's another country. So I was like, okay, fine. I'll do it again. So I had it beaten out of me over the years. But, you know, it's still very much part of my identity.
Well, for those who live in a cardboard box at the bottom of the ocean and they've never heard of the name Laura Logan, who is Laura Logan? I know that you're from South Africa, but tell me more.
Born and raised in South Africa, and I have lived and worked all over the world. I've been a journalist since I was 17 years old, and unfortunately, I'm 51 now. And I spent much of my career, in fact, most of it, as a correspondent for CBS News and 60 Minutes. I was the chief foreign correspondent, and then the chief foreign affairs correspondent, and blah, 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 you know. And but I worked at ABC and NBC. I started out in newspapers. So I was a newspaper reporter. I spent many years reporting at CBS Radio, which I loved. I even wrote for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. So I've had a long career. And I finally just became an American citizen, actually, not that long ago, just a few weeks ago. And I'm married to an American and have my children here. So I guess that means I'm never going home to live. But I chose a part of America that reminds me a lot of the South African bush. I'm in the hill country in central Texas, and there's a lot of the landscape and the animals and everything that you would see at home.
Is there still a bit of South Africa in you?
Oh, there's a lot of South Africa in me. Are you kidding? I always think about, I remember when Mobutu Sese Seko, the former leader of Zaire, was dying, and he asked to be taken back to his village. And I remember talking to people then and reading a lot about it and trying to understand why for this, you know, long running dictator, was this his final wish? And it was, he said, you know, as Africans, as we get older, we feel the earth calling us back, calling us home. And I feel that pull very strongly. I miss my home. I miss my country. I miss the people. I miss everything that it represents. But of course, it's changed a lot. And what's funny is, at the same time, I can be really happy here. And I really feel such a debt of gratitude to the U.S. for the life that I've had and for the values and the principles. And there is something quite extraordinary about knowing that what we do here, you know, this is what I said to people. I just spoke this past week with a number of groups in Houston, Texas, and it was quite amazing because I said to this whole room full of people, you know, I'm not sure you understand the power that you have in your hands as we the people, because what you do here directly impacts people all over the world. And I think that's something that a lot of Americans maybe don't understand or forget. Is just how much the decisions they make and the things they do here, how much they resonate and how much they matter in the farthest reaches of the earth. And that is something, that's something else, boy. That's quite something. Of course, I really like also having the understanding as a South African of growing up in a place where you know you don't matter, right? and so that gives me, I think, a certain humility in and it really puts me, my feet are firmly planted on the ground. That definitely happened at home in South Africa. You know, I got my sense of perspective on the world and my own tiny insignificant place in all of it.
Last time you and I chatted, you said to me that you're a beach girl.
Oh, yes, I am. I cried the first time I went to a beach in England. I did.
Because it's terrible.
We went for a long drive, my ex-husband and I, who was just a fabulous man. And I love him still. And he was so excited to take me to a beach because we were living in London and he knew how much I missed the ocean and how badly I wanted to be by the water. And so he drove me hours to a beach and made me close my eyes and led me by the hand. And when I opened my eyes and saw the beach, I think it was in Southampton. I can't remember exactly, but I just started crying. And I just didn't know how to explain to him. I grew up on the wild coast. I grew up in the Transkei. You know, we didn't live there, but that's where we spent every vacation. And I can't begin to tell you how far removed this is from the sand and the water and the everything. So, but I learned to be grateful for where I was. It's, I always think of that song, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with. It's kind of like, if you can't be on the beach you love, you know, then love the beach you're on.
What do you miss about South Africa? Sorry, I'm harping on South Africa for a second, but it's because I don't get to speak to that many. I don't speak to that many South Africans on the radio.
I miss the spirit of South Africa. I miss that sense of being forever in the sun. I don't know why you have that sense when you grow up there, but it is like living forever in the sunshine. And I think maybe that's because it's the spirit of the people is truly bathed in light. And so for me, that light is a perpetual summer. I really miss my family. Oh,
are they here in South Africa?
Yeah, they're most of them are in South Africa. And so that is a wound that will never heal and a pain that never goes away and a longing that grows stronger the longer you're gone. So that's very hard, but, there's an entrepreneurial spirit. Mm. When you grow up in a place where, you know, we don't really matter in terms of geopolitics and all of that, and you're fine with that. You don't have any issue with that. But there is, what did they say in South Africa? A boer maak 'n plan, maar die engels doen het beter, right? And that's really a way of saying that you figure out a way to make things happen. And I love that. And of course, we have such a beautiful country, right? So the water is beautiful, the garden route, and the Drakensberg Mountains that I miss. I miss all of that. And just those very South African things, you know. We'll see you just now. When are you getting there? Just now. I'll be there just now.
Yeah, that's one of those things that people don't understand. It's a weird South Africanism saying just now. It doesn't mean what it means anywhere else in the world.
Nope. My children love to make fun of me and my accent and, you know, and sometimes, especially with their homework, we argue over English. But the just now thing, yeah, that's so you hear someone say that, you know they're South African.
So for those listening, when we in South Africa say just now, it means how do you explain it? It means it's to come, but very soon.
It means whenever we show up.
So if I say I'm coming just now, it means I'm coming at some point in the near future.
Correct. Yeah, my best. That's the other part of it that they don't get, right? It means I'm going to do my best and I'll be there as soon as I can.
I'm so glad you haven't forgotten that.
For all my problems with time.
Why did you become a journalist, Laura?
Honestly, I wanted to know. I wanted to understand. And I learned very early on that, you know, if you wanted your writing to mean anything, if you wanted to have anything valuable to say, that it needed to come from firsthand experience. That when you try to imagine things, you know, it's rarely as powerful or memorable as when you've actually lived through it. And I realized that as a young white girl in South Africa, who cared what a young white girl had to say, right? I mean, it was the experiences and the misery and the suffering and struggle of black people that was of real value. And so I always felt slightly unworthy, right? How could I be worthy? Why would anyone want to read anything I had to offer? So that was part of it. But really what drove me was I understood that I needed to see for myself. I needed to see firsthand because understanding begins there. And I was not built for politics. I was never going to be the activist or carry the party flag or, you know, carry the party statement or logo or anything else. I understood from a very early age that, for example, this was actually a real example for me. When a lot of people were being necklaced in South Africa, so informants and people like that, if they were found in the townships, you'd have a tire put over them, gasoline poured on them, they'd often be hacked to pieces at the same time, and they would be set on fire. And I realized when I looked at that, I didn't want to own that. I didn't want to represent that. I wanted to be able to look at that and say, you know, I understand the source of the anger and I understand, you know, why these things are happening, but I don't have to endorse them. And that's when I, you know, really reinforced my decision to be a journalist, because as a journalist, you don't have to endorse anything. It's not part of the job. You know, you can report on something that's really important to you, like child sex trafficking is really important to me. So if I can write stories or expose the reality of that, that's going to mean a lot to me. But if I discover that, for example, the organization that saved more children than anybody else, and yet they are trafficking in children, or there's things that they're not doing right, I'm still going to report on that. Whereas if I, you know, if I was an activist, I wouldn't be doing that because my responsibility and loyalty would be to the organization or to the party or, you know, and so on. And that's not who I am. I am not built that way. I think it's so important for people to know and understand that journalists are not activists and we are not political operatives and we are not lawyers in a court of law trying to prove a case. And if you understand that, then you can avoid one of the most egregious mistakes in journalism, which is to try to prove that something is right or that is true. Instead of looking at the facts and understanding and finding the truth and letting that speak for itself. It's a subtle difference, but it means everything.
So what is the role of a journalist?
Well, you know, as long as newspapers have been around, right, you've had opinion pages where people give their opinions and analysis and so on. And sometimes as a television reporter, I would be asked for an analysis. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's plenty of shows that are more interesting and have a much bigger audience because people are interested in the opinion of the host and they enjoy the way that that plays out in the format of the show. And that is very, very valid, right? I mean, I can think of Tucker Carlson as one of the great examples of that. Maybe your show is like that to many people because they know where you stand on all these different issues, right? But there is unquestionably a major hole. If we all gravitate towards opinion-oriented journalism, then there is a hole in terms of letting the facts speak for themselves. I always think that our role as journalists is to figure out the truth, follow that those facts, regardless of where they take you, and to report them as honestly and accurately as possible, setting aside your own bias and your own prejudice as much as humanly, you know, possible, as much as you can. And that's and that means being aware of your own bias too, and doing that so that you can get out of the way and let the story speak for itself, let the characters speak for themselves, you know. And that is not an objective process. It's an extremely subjective process. But if you take refuge in the standards, right, in that, what do I mean by standards? Well, we know that it's better to have multiple sources than to have just one. Sometimes that's not possible, but it means evaluating your source. And it's better to have first-hand sources. Two first-hand sources is the basic rule, rather than second-hand sources, right? So relying on what someone else reported, that would be a no-no. You know, you're not supposed to do that. Now, you could argue that, okay, well, that's been vetted to some degree. It's been public and so on and so on. But look how we see so many things that are reported over and over and over again and widely reported, and they turn out to have no basis in fact whatsoever. So that's a trap that many of us fall into. But the reality is that when you really do this job well, it's extremely difficult. And that's why it's hard to do a daily news show and to live up to all those things. That's why it matters that we have not just daily shows, but weekly shows and investigative shows and so on, because you need all those forms of reporting. And you need people to have the luxury of time to live up to those standards, as well as chasing the daily news and the breaking news.
How do you balance the tug of war between facts and storytelling?
No, it's not a tug of war. It's there's no compromise there. Absolutely no compromise. It's the art of storytelling as you weave in the facts. You make right. every sentence count. That's your job, right? Make every sentence count. And I know what you mean in the sense that in daily news, sometimes having to get in certain details that they can sort of get in the way of a great narrative. But that's why I said this is hard. When you do it well, it's extremely difficult. And I learned at 60 Minutes how to make every word count. And I learned what that really means, you know, because a lot of people can say it, but they don't really understand what it means. And it means that you don't waste time on these sort of meaningless transitions that you might hear in television sometimes when someone is just trying to make something flow, or they're trying to get you from one part of the story to another without really thinking about how to make those words count. And I tell you, once you figure out how to do that, it's really quite motivating, right? It's very powerful. And I there's a real art to it, and that's what I hope that people will understand, you know, that that it's worth fighting to hold on to that art, because without it, you know, journalism really descends very quickly into state-run propaganda and people yelling at each other.
Laura, I'll continue with you after this break.
Mercy Ships is launching a new hospital ship to provide free surgeries to the forgotten poor. But we urgently need 3,000 volunteers to serve in all positions. To learn more, visit mercyships.org/volunteer.
Government has taken our rights and will never give them back unless we make them. The voice of freedom is TNT Radio.
Okay.
So listen here, Jeremy, look. The Taliban stepped into power as President Ashraf Ghani stepped down, his seat at the presidential palace not yet cold. Said sure. a lot in that. That's a short, small amount of words, right? But they say a lot. A victory forged in the blood of an American betrayal, almost 20 years to the day since 9/11. So here, racing to Kabul airport to flee, swarming the runway in scenes unlike anything the world had ever witnessed. Two people who held on to this military transport plane that was taking Americans to safety, so desperate they never let go, barely visible as they tumbled through the air to their deaths.
Oh, it's poetic.
Yeah, in the war against Islamic terrorists here, Muslims have long paid the heaviest price. Women and children often targeted by the Taliban and other Islamic extremists. Like the girls at this school in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Three explosions earlier this year tore through flesh and bones, leaving 83 dead and fear in their wake.
So that's the combination of storytelling and facts.
It's the combination of storytelling and facts woven together, but also using the reporter's eye and experience, pulling in all the other facts, analyzing them, and knowing which pieces to pull out. And these are subjective decisions. It's why journalists don't like to admit that we make subjective decisions all the time, but we do. But when you do it well and when you do it honestly, they're based on real facts, not just based on opinions or suspicions or something else, right? I mean, that's more than 20 years of covering the Afghan war, understanding what those things mean, right? That's why you notice I said in the war against Islamic terrorists here, Muslims have long paid the heaviest price. Because what am I doing there? I'm doing something really critically important, which is reminding or informing people that these terrorists have killed more Muslims than anyone else. So when you try to paint this as a war between Islam and the West, you're denying one of the most fundamental, easily provable facts, which is on a daily basis, Islamic terrorists kill more Muslims than anyone. So who is their war really against? Do you see what I mean? And so, like, for example, here, Afghan families have buried up to 70,000 policemen and soldiers since 2001, according to a recent report from Brown University's Cost of War Project. A casualty rate so high, military convention said no army could sustain it. Yet after heading into battle day and night for 20 years without end, the scale and speed of the U.S. withdrawal delivered them into the hands of their enemy.
Sure.
So that's built on understanding and knowing, looking at those casualty rates, talking to multiple experts, knowing that there's never been an army that sustained a casualty rate that high and lived to keep fighting, right? And look what I said, it was the scale and speed of the U.S. withdrawal that delivered them into the hands of their enemy. Because if they hadn't done it like that, you would not have had the same result. Now, those are not the only factors. There's the whole betrayal and selling them out to Pakistan that comes into it. But you can't deliver each thing. You can't overload people with information. So those things have to unfold as the story goes on.
And that's really what it is, isn't it? It's telling a story so that people can relate to it.
That's what I do. Tell me a story, right? And I want to tell you a story, but guess what? It's going to be a true story. And that means I can't lie and I can't embellish and I can't tell you things that I don't know to be true. I told you it was going to be true at the very beginning. So then I've got to keep my promise I made to you, right? That's a commitment I made. I've got to meet that commitment. I can't take chances on that. That's not right. So, you know, like here's an introduction into a character right in this story. Dave Rubin was his name. Rubin is not your typical DC academic. He prefers to do his research on the ground, and his office is testament to his commitment to live what he learns firsthand. The walls he showed me lined with moments from history he had witnessed that helped shape his understanding. So how many academics never get out? They write intellectually and academically about stuff that they've never seen, places they've never been to. So this guy was different. Right? He didn't do that. And so, and how do I turn a scene in television where he's showing me a tiny little office cubicle and he's got these things on the wall? How do I make that interesting? How does it mean something? Well, I don't make up something. I think about it and I take the time to consider and I use that experience of knowing the world of academia and I give that context and I give it meaning. I do what? I tell you the rest of the story. That's what the show that I'm going to launch is going to be about. It's the rest of the story, because it's the parts of the story that you don't normally hear or that you might, you know, never have been told.
This has taken you years, though. I mean, this has been a journey to get to this point. You didn't do this off the bat.
No.
So what I'm alluding to is, tell me a little bit about that journey. Because obviously that included some very interesting experiences.
Well, you know, I would say looking back at it, so I've worked in Afghanistan. I spent, you know, years there, and I spent 5 years living in Iraq. I lived in Israel. I was there for the Second Intifada and the war with Hezbollah and so on and so on. I've worked in China and all over Africa. Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Zambia, Burundi, Uganda, Kenya, Botswana, Swaziland, obviously South Africa. You know, and I can keep going, right? And going Egypt. What I have along the way, I've been lucky enough, I think, to be kept to be kept alive for a reason. I made smart decisions. I tried always to make smart decisions, but I tried never to do things for the wrong reasons. And that's really, I think, what led to the smart decisions. So, for example, when I was living with Afghan soldiers in the time of the Taliban, when they owned more than 90% of the country still, and every night Afghan leaders would come out of Kabul and other places, and I was living with Afghan soldiers on their front line. So the Afghan general, you know, the first night I was there, I wake up in the middle of the night, and I'm sleeping on the floor, of course, and these soldiers have their, one of them has his hand over my mouth, and they have all got their weapons, and they're all staring at me, and they're like, they don't speak English, so they motion to me to come with them. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, this is the moment, right, where I find out what the general really meant when he said you could stay here. And I'm praying that the worst, it's not going to be the worst, but I have faith. I have faith in people, and I have faith in my instincts. And what does he take me to? And it's not a late night booty call, right? I'm not about to be jumped by an Afghan general in his man jammies. No, what is all these leaders of the Taliban, and he's meeting with them, and they're all drinking together, and I'm invited to this. And I did this night after night after night for months as the U.S. was bombing Kabul. And so I really came to understand, you know, the nature of some of these complicated relationships in Afghanistan, and a lot of the history and the culture. And I understood it, you know, a lot of it in those late night drinking sessions with Taliban leaders, more than I would have ever understood it from Washington, D.C., or, you know, from living with some network and going down to a managed press conference or something like that. Not that everybody does it that way, but I just found that those, you know, that way of operating to be very, very limited. And so I was always criticized for pushing the envelope, but that was, I didn't ever pay any attention to that, because that was so obviously to me the wrong way to do things. And there are plenty of, every real journalist knows that that's what you've got to do. But my point is, those Taliban leaders would invite me to Kabul every night. They would say, come with us. And I knew and understood that the level of risk involved in doing that was way too high. And what I also understood was that you take those risks when you have something truly unique to offer in terms of the story and in terms of what we know and understand. And at that time, the BBC had a fabulous journalist, Raghi Omar, in Kabul. I think he was the only foreign journalist there, if I remember correctly. And so we were getting some sense of what it was like in Kabul overnight, right? You would hear that from Raghi and his reporting. So I didn't see any editorial justification. What am I just going to prove to the world how brave I am and that I can also, you know, report from Kabul under fire? No, I was under fire every day on the front line anyway. And so people think that these are random decisions. They think that, you know, they might read about me online and it says I'm reckless and blah, blah, blah. But it was never true. I was never reckless. I had a higher threshold than a lot of people because I was born and raised in Africa, and it's, you know, in South Africa. And I mean, think about it. We would go away on vacation with my family down to Suleka on the wild coast. There was no electricity. There was no, well, maybe there was running water. We had an old gas heater. There were cows on the beach. And, you know, it was a totally different world. And I think that those experiences, you know, people might, they looked at me sometimes and thought, oh, yeah, sure, here we go. Let's see Barbie go to war. And they would think I wasn't going to last a second. And I outlasted all of them. You know, I outlasted all of them, which was just fun, to be honest. Because when you're covering the Afghan war and their supply lines from Pakistan, that's nothing compared to covering the Angola civil war or the war in Mozambique. When there really is nothing, when there's no food, there's no food. Right? That's it. So, you know, you're living on for 8 days, one chicken that someone managed to kill. one of the guys in the convoy that we were on, you know, managed to get this chicken. I mean, then you really understand about the hardships of covering war and the realities of war when you live and see it like that. So I've been very lucky because I've had an angel on my shoulder all these years, and I've learned so much from other journalists and from all the people in the places that I've gone, many of whom I still carry with me now.
Laura, I have to quickly go to the news headlines.
Darren Metzer here with a look at your TNT headlines. For the first time since World War II, Russia has ordered the immediate partial mobilization of its military reservists to defend the motherland. Hurricane Fiona has intensified into a Category 3 storm, and could reach Category 4 strength, after devastating parts of Puerto Rico. And hundreds of whales have washed up on a stretch of coast in the Australian state of Tasmania.
When you need to know what's going on around the world and at home, keep it on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Laura, how... No, let me rephrase that, not how. What attracted you to war journalism?
Well, I grew up in a war, right? It was a different kind of war in South Africa. But I understood that there were things happening in the townships beyond our reach. And I did not want to listen to what the government had to say about it. I wanted to see it for myself. And so it was a natural progression for me to go from the townships of South Africa to the killing fields of Kosovo or... all the other places that I've been. And it wasn't so much what attracted me as I understood that if you really want to see humanity at its very best and at its worst, in these places of extremes is where you would find that. And I was good at it, you know? I was good at angling my way into the furthest reaches, someplace that nobody else wanted to go. And then also I always had a higher threshold for those things. And so it was very appealing to me. I wanted to follow the story and go wherever it took me. And it took me to those places. And I knew I wasn't cut out for politics. I was never politically defined. And that was just, you know, that kind of treacherous skullduggery and the disingenuous nature of so much of politics was never in my DNA. And I wasn't born to be a sports reporter or, a music or entertainment reporter. You know, I was fascinated by very profound, real things. And even though I love those other kinds of journalism, they just weren't what motivated me. And what motivated me was to see and understand firsthand and to be in those environments where people had no voice and it mattered. Their voices really mattered. And they helped us understand more about that situation, but also more about everything, right? About ourselves, about humanity, about my dogs are barking, about the direction of nations and all of those things. So it was never about being an adrenaline junkie. People ask me that all the time. There's no adrenaline in watching people die.
Did you ever think you were going to die?
Oh, yeah. Many times. Many, many, many times. I mean, I was in so many firefights and clashes that I never reported on. Even, you know, coming back late at night from a shoot or whatever, when your convoy gets attacked and you find yourself hiding behind some kind of barrier thinking, I'm not even going to tell the office about this one. That happened to me a lot. And then, of course, I was blown up in Afghanistan in, I think, was it 2001 or 2? Our convoy hit a double anti-tank mine, and we were in an ambush. I was in an ambush in Ramadi in Iraq with a guy right in front of me. I was in the kill zone of the ambush because they shot the Marine right in front of me. They blew up our hotel underneath us in Baghdad at the CBS Bureau, killed 13 people right underneath me. We had marksmen, trained marksmen. They call them snipers, but really, I'm not sure that they're at the level of snipers, but it's nothing like running around in Mosul with ISIS marksmen following you every step, and you can hear that sickening whine of the bullets as they're zinging past you, and you realize as they're following you that you're the target. That was just awful, you know? That was and harder for me because my children were a little older then, and so I knew, I felt very responsible. But it's one thing when you're there witnessing events and you're just lucky that you weren't killed as well. It's something else entirely when, you know, they're shooting at you specifically, and you specifically are being targeted. And then, of course, you know, the most well-known incident of all is when I was gang raped and sodomized and beaten almost to death in a Tahrir square in Egypt. But there have been many moments along the way when I didn't have the certainty that I was going to see the other side of that moment.
And yet you carried on.
Sure. Oh, you're not going to let that stop you, are you? I mean, of course. That's like asking a chair not to be a chair, you know?
So being a journalist is not a job, it's part of who you are.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, it's definitely part of who I am. I don't define myself entirely by work, but the work that I do is very much like I'm working on stuff related to child sex trafficking. I mean, this is not a job. It's not something that you come into work and just work on that and then you leave it behind. You take it with you. And that's important, too, because it allows you to connect the dots, right, with all the things I've witnessed in my life. Like working on Satanism in South Africa as a young reporter really provided a powerful and important foundation for me for covering Satanism here in the U.S. and around the world today. Right. So all those little dots, they connect. They're like pieces of a puzzle that make up this great understanding of yours. And it means nothing if you just leave it all behind or give up.
Do you feel you have pieced together a lot of the puzzle?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, I'm 51 and I've been doing this since I was 17. So that's several decades, right? So obviously, over that time, I've learned an enormous amount. But as a journalist, I'm always conscious of what I don't know. And I always feel like what I don't know is so overwhelming, you know, that there's much more I don't know than I do. So at the same time, I recognize that, you know, after doing this for a long time, it's not the same. I see these young journalists starting out, and I think back to a time where I was that naive, or where I was also being used, right? Because now I realize I was used many times in my career without knowing it then. But at the same time, I've always told the people I work with that anytime they find me acting like the smartest person in the room, they have permission to shoot me. Take me out back and put me out of my misery, because that's not how you learn, and it's not what being a good journalist is all about. There is no such thing as an expert, really, in my world, because I can never know enough.
What has been the biggest lesson that you've learned from all your journalism?
I would say the biggest lesson is to be aware of your own bias, because I spent many, many years convinced that we were all just, you know, engaged in the noble pursuit of real journalism and learning the truth about things. And I didn't realize that I was in a bubble of sorts, that, you know, most of the people around me thought the same way and believed in the same things. And so we had accepted certain things as fact and as the truth without fully vetting and verifying them. And they call that confirmation bias in some respects, but I don't mean it just in that sense. I mean it in the sense that, you know, you need to be as critical and questioning of the people who you like and agree with as much as you are the people that you may not like. Or, and, you know, and definitely don't agree with. And I think that really feeds into our bias, because it's pretty sad to me today that people will just make up their minds without really listening and without really paying attention, you know. So it becomes easier to use cancel culture and to smear people and so on, because no one is thinking critically and no one's really questioning. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that it's a very important lesson to become aware of your own bias, because that will save you from making some basic mistakes, and it'll save you from also appealing only to the converted, right? It'll give you the ability to reach across different lanes and to talk to as many people as you possibly can, because that's the goal in the end, right? Is you want to reach as many people as you can so that they can take that story and they can take that information and they can make good decisions with it. And they can, you know, decide for themselves where they stand and what they believe in. That's not up to me. That's not my job.
Mm. Laura, I'm going to my last ad rotation. I'll be back with you in a moment.
When it feels like the world has stopped, good finds a way. Good never stops, and neither does Children International. To learn more, go to children.org/help.
Show me the studies.
Today's News Talk Radio.
True study. This is safe for adults, much less kids.
TNT Radio. Live.
What has happened to journalism during the COVID era?
I don't think it's so much the COVID era as, I mean, maybe that's the way that it appears from South Africa, because a lot of these changes, you know, seem timed around that. But for me, it began much earlier than that. I was shocked when I was attacked over my reporting on Benghazi. I mean, not least because it was obvious that almost none of the reporters that were writing about what we did in our story and what our story was about had ever watched it, because if they did, they wouldn't have written that. But it was really that I never thought that we would be attacked for doing our jobs and doing our jobs honestly. And that's what we did. And yet we got savaged for it.
So what actually happened? Let's create the context. What actually happened?
Well, it was just very simple that we did a story that was originally about the two Delta guys who were in the Libya, U.S. embassy in Libya, when Christopher Stevens, the ambassador who was killed, made his first call for help. And these guys ended up collecting money and hiring a plane and going down to Benghazi. And not only did they recover Chris Stevens' body from the hospital, but they fought their way into the annex, which was the CIA annex, separate from the special mission compound. And that was where they prevented what they said, well, and many people have acknowledged, would have been the worst U.S. hostage crisis since the Iranian hostage crisis. And they fought their way in. With the help of a local militia, and they freed the U.S. personnel who were there, and they brought out the bodies of Ty Woods and Glenn Doherty. And nobody knew about them until we reported on them. Their entire role and their existence was not acknowledged or known. We broke that story. That was the story that we set out to do. And then 6 months into that investigation, which was very difficult because the Obama White House did not want anybody talking to the media about any part of that operation. They wanted it all to go away. And so that made it very hard. And then we were through the book department at 60 Minutes. We were introduced to several different authors of different books, and we rejected them one after another because they lacked credibility. But here was one that was backed by the company, and it related to the first eyewitness who was on the ground that night, who had actually gone to the compound and seen things with his own eyes. And of course, they must have studied me well, because having that firsthand source to give you a firsthand account, you know, we thought we were on solid ground with that. But we were asked to sign an NDA which is a non-disclosure agreement by the book publisher and the author, this guy, because he said that, you know, we could vet anything we wanted except for the contents, this, the details of what he did that night during the attack. And so that's what we did. We got, we photographed the stamps in his passport that showed when he was in Benghazi and when he left, to match that with the State Department contract that he had. We went to the State Department and we verified his employment. And every time he said a camera was broken and this happened and that happened, we verified that. We just couldn't vet what he said happened that night. And of course, that's the part that they attacked, right? And they said that what he told us wasn't right. But the guy disappeared. And that was, I don't think, an accident. He said he got a death. He was threatened with his life, and he filed a police report with the Welsh police. We called the Welsh police, and we confirmed that. But, you know, was it a real report? Was it not? You never, ever know. It appears more and more likely that he may have been just paid to go away, because if he wasn't defending himself, we couldn't defend him. Mm. And so they cast doubt on his account of that night. He said he told the FBI everything that he did. And, of course, at the time, I said to my boss, gosh, I hope the FBI doesn't lie, you know, and say that's not what he told us. My boss said to me, are you suggesting that the FBI would lie about something like that? Are you nuts?
Yeah, of course not.
Yeah, that would never happen. Gosh, fast forward to today, right? Does anyone believe what the FBI tells them anymore? I don't know. I don't think so.
Or the CIA.
You know, so what I learned the hard way was that journalists who were writing about me and wanting to take me down because of that piece, they were writing things that were blatantly false. They didn't even take the time to watch a 13-minute story, right? And of course, you know, they made that story disappear from the internet so that people couldn't see it and see the truth for themselves. But what that story was really about, this guy was just one character. He was one of three, and he was the least important. He was in there just because he was a firsthand eyewitness. And the FBI, we had reviewed emails from some of their undercover agents that had asked this guy to identify people who were suspected of being involved, who he had seen at the scene. So we know that he went there and that they know that he went there, but they dispute one small part of his story, and we still don't know the truth. That's the reality, because this guy has never come forward to tell the truth.
Let me ask my question in a different way then. How has the COVID era influenced or affected your life?
Well, you know, the sad part about COVID is that it was obvious from the very beginning that the way they were responding to it with lockdowns and everything else, that it was going to cause widespread poverty and economic collapse. And that's exactly what we've seen, right? And it also did something very significant. It pushed us faster into a digital future, where we were telling our kids to Zoom into school classes and do their homework on Zoom and all the rest of it. But we or Google Classroom, whatever the app is, we don't tell our kids at the same time that, yes, it's great, we can do telehealth. But that means that, you know, the laws in this country that protect your personal health information, those laws have been obliterated. And there's a really dark side to the technology, and even using it innocuously, they're still collecting data on you to use not just for advertising, but to use for control of you and to use against you in many respects. And so what I saw happening during COVID was easily preventable and easily predictable. And it's even worse for the people who have vaccine injured or vaccine dead, right, in their lives. My father died, and I wasn't able to bury him and say a proper goodbye in person. And so that was very painful. But what I see is that, you know, I remember the time when everyone started talking about the new normal, the new normal, the new normal, and being so frustrated, because what was the reason we couldn't go back to the old normal? And but what that indicated was that there was a plan for the new normal, wasn't there? Mm. You know, they were determined to never let it go back. And I think that plan has revealed itself more and more with each passing day. And it is a plan where we don't go back to anything approaching normal, because they're not going to let us. They're not going to allow for that. Even though COVID is long gone in many, many respects where I live, that doesn't mean people don't get sick, and it doesn't mean people don't die. Those are very serious things, and I'm not dismissing them at all. But people die of the flu, right? People get very sick with flu. Mm. And we've never punished the healthy because of that. But yet with COVID, we did. And that punishment still continues. I knew no one would care about the people in poverty all across Africa and other places. And look now how so many countries are suffering. And who cares? Nobody cares.
Least of all, Brandon.
Least of all, President Brandon. Yeah, no, he doesn't care one bit. In fact, all of his policies, if they're even his policies, are about making the situation worse, not better, because they want the situation to collapse. If it collapses in on itself, then there's justification for changing it, right? For a rebirth or a great reset, as they like to say at the World Economic Forum.
Time is against us, Laura. I'd like to get some, what's the word I'm looking for? Inspiration from a great journalist such as yourself. What advice or what life lessons do you have that at the top of your head you're willing to impart?
Don't be afraid. We can't live in fear. And courage is not the absence of fear. I didn't say this. This is a quote. Courage is not the absence of fear. It's acting in the presence of fear. Right. So if you're afraid and you feel that in the pit of your stomach, if you're afraid to speak up, afraid to be an outlier, afraid of the consequences, don't live in fear, because there is no escape from that. Once you make that deal with the devil and you turn your back on the truth and everything that comes with that, including God, what you find is that you have just now consigned yourselves to the depths of hell, right, from which there is no escape. And it's not going to get better just if you can stay under the radar and stay out of it and avoid the consequences. It's not going to fix itself. And we're in the midst of a really vast criminal conspiracy to cause many countries to fail, so that people, for one reason or another, will accept regional governments, then global governments, and then basically a time of no elections whatsoever, right? Where we don't have leaders that are elected with the consent of the governed. And where we're headed is such a dark place that I would say to people, don't fear what you could lose, because much of that is not real. It doesn't really exist. And what you have in front of you instead is the most extraordinary opportunity, which is to define these things going forward. What you do now and the decisions you make now will literally define the path forward for hundreds of millions of people to come. And that is a gift. It's not a burden, curse. It's a real gift. Your life will matter more than you could ever have imagined if you embrace the difficulty and embrace the fear and act in spite of it. I think that's, few people in their lifetimes get to make such a difference and such a contribution to the world as we have before us now. Every human being has this opportunity now. And so take it with both hands and run with it. And don't let anyone stop you.
Where can I follow you?
On Locals. I'm on Locals, which is an app. I have, general subscribers and paid subscribers. And I'm on Truth Social and Getter. I don't do the apps that essentially traffic in kids and children and various other things. I'm not a fan of that, so I don't want to enrich those people. So I stay off the YouTube and Instagram and Facebook and all that as much as I possibly can. It's a process, weaning yourself from these things. But for the most part, you won't find me on Twitter anymore. I mean, I have a page there, but I used to be out there, you know, in the trenches, and not anymore.
Well, speaking of the trenches, Laura Logan, thank you for joining me in them.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jeremy. I love talking to you.